change from one stand to another. Complete change, over, changing over from one thought to another.
Well, I don't think that you put the word radical with complete. It does mean something that affects the very root of action. That is, and the activities or the discipline that leads to yoga is radical, thoroughgoing. That's one of the meanings of radical, thoroughgoing. And it's in that sense it depends on the text, by the way. I cannot help but recommend the use of the dictionary. Some of these questions can be answered from that. And bear in mind that I'm more apt to use the word closer to its root meaning rather than to its popular application. There's a question, where does the unity of the self come in? Does it stand behind the subjective? I don't altogether get the bearing of the question. You know, the self is one. That's our experience of it. The universe, which stands in contrast to the subject, I use the self as synonymous with subject. It is multiform, manifold. But that manifoldness becomes unified through the self of the apperceiver. It is unified as my experience. I am one, universe many. I think you get that from analysis. Ultimately, in your search for the pure subject, you find that which is present in all individuals. And it's one. Oneness is its characteristic. And manyness is characteristic of the universe of objects. Bear in mind, I use the word universe to represent anything that's objective, whether subtle or gross, whether what we ordinarily think of as things or as ideas. That makes up the universe. That's the sense in which Shankara uses. Equivalent to the sense of Sankara, yes, of the Buddhist. The self is the subjective problem. The unity of the self implies duality. Well, of course, you can't say one without implying two or many. It's the one pole of the subject-object consciousness, which is our familiar consciousness, a self-aware of a world around. Now, in your yoga, and this has particular reference to Janani Yoga and its technique, your first effort is the isolation of the self and establishment of identification with it alone. You can recognize the self is known by different names. It's known as the witness. That which gives the sanction or rejects. Your practical technique, when you have learned to take the stand of the witness or of the self in effecting any change, is simply apply kind of rejection without will ever. You reject any course in the nature, and sooner or later, that tendency in the nature runs out, loses its force, because it's no longer sanctioned by the self or the witness. Bear in mind, I mean by witness and self the same thing. They're not two entities. But just two facets of meaning. It is the giver of the sanction, as well as the witness. It is the center of the consciousness of all beings. See tomorrow. Would you say that as long as we dwell on finding subjectivity, we never can get beyond that point? But if you really arrive at the self as distinct from the ego, you don't need to worry. I found that autonomous process or spontaneous process to come from that.
Here comes Charles Seymour. Here comes Charles
Seymour. Who's your mom? Wait for a while then. Well, how did you know?
I don't even know.
Well, reading a manuscript that I have, which has been put upon tape and is available for use here in Chicago and to some extent down at Douglas and Tucson. But as it's listened to, questions arise, and that's one thing I can contribute is some answers to these questions. Otherwise, they haven't. Here's the question: is it wrong to be preoccupied with the divine, to be so preoccupied with the divine, that is what we see in everything? Well, I'd say, what could be more right than that? I don't know how in the world a person could suggest any wrongness in that. Yeah. Lucky you are if you see the divine in everything at all times. It's a long way.
Is this what we're really striving for? Is it the teaching, isn't it?
Yes, that's one picture, one way of viewing it. Seeing the divine in all things belongs more preeminently to karma and bhakti, to yoga. Seeing all things as a maya and the divine as transcendental and a realization being essentially a departure from all world is more characteristic of Jnana. The full integral yoga involves both features, and as either karma yoga or bhakti yoga seems to be more available to people, the practice, the effort to see the divine in all things is one of the most important disciplines. No, you can't overdo that. How would you describe the content of consciousness as used in the doctrine? Well, the content of consciousness is everything of which you can be conscious. The universe, your system of ideas, your feeling tone, states, all modifications of consciousness. Content of consciousness is used in that sense in the manuscript. So it's everything of which we are usually aware. It's only as you advance in yoga that you become cognizant of the fact that there is a subject or a self that is aware of all of these things, and that you have arrived at the true subject only when you no longer seek to make it into a subtle object. If that which you call the self can be a content of your consciousness, it is not the self. You've got an ego, or you've got a surrogate of the self. The true self can never be a content. It is that on which all content rests, depends. Now, anything more? Any comment or any further questions upon that section that you read last time or heard? This, by the way, is commentary on the aphorisms, the first general commentary, which is part two of this manuscript. It consists of several subsections, about 16 or 17, in which I generally discuss an idea that's bound to be more or less strange. It is followed then by commentary upon each aphorism by itself. Now, I have a figure here in the next section that begins to be a little technical, because it's drawn from modern physics, and its value lies in this, that it should make the basic concepts in the aphorisms not so strange as they might seem at first sight. And you remember the first five run this way: consciousness without an object is. Second, before objects were. Consciousness without an object is. Third, when objects seem to exist, consciousness without an object is. When objects vanish, yet remaining unaffected, consciousness without an object is. Beside consciousness without an object, nothing is. Now, but it's just those five. Most people who have read them said that they aroused no meaning at all. It didn't correspond to anything thinkable. Now, in this particular subsection, I think I can show that a similar idea already exists in the thought of the physicists, and thus it is not so strange in its logical schema. But this you may find a little difficult, and the language here was corrected to fit modern physical technical terminology by Dr. Melvin, who had been a professor at Columbia University, was a trained theoretical physicist and was teaching in the Columbia School of Mines prior to the time that he came to live with us for a time. Modern physics and astronomy have developed a speculative conception which is, in some respects, an inverse reflection of the view elaborated here. This interpretation is derived from certain facts which have come to light in recent decades, partly as a result of the development of instrumental aids to observation, and partly as a result of progress in interpretive theory. It now appears quite clearly that the older conception of matter as being composed of unchanging
and indestructible atoms does not faithfully interpret the facts derived through experience. Here's a footnote. It would be more correct to say that the older conception can no longer interpret the facts as simply as the newer conception. It is always possible to make the older conception work by adding intricate interpretations through ad hoc hypotheses, but this is done at the price of clumsiness and complication. It is not change in the factual picture that compels change in theory, but the greater logical beauty and efficacy of the new theory. I don't know whether what I'm saying here can be very clear, because you would have to be up a bit on scientific methodology and the philosophic interpretations that are forced by science to appreciate what is here said. But if you have a question that I might be able to answer, bring it up at any time. It has become necessary to conceive of the atom. Oh, as I might elaborate a little further on this very point, that facts don't force the change of conception so much as the conception of simplicity and beauty forces it. Now, we could treat the whole universe in its relation of motion from the earth as a base of reference, as is done in the Ptolemaic system. In that case, the motion of the planets takes a complex form of cycloids and epicycloids and epicycloids, building up altogether a very complicated figure of motion. But nonetheless, it's logically valid to so approach the universe. And in that case, you would say the sun goes around the earth every 24 hours. In fact, the whole stellar universe goes around the earth every 24 hours. There's no logical difficulty with it. But there's enormous complication if you try to handle problems of building a thinkable picture of the total universe. But on the other hand, if you take the sun, or perhaps even more exactly, the sun with the ecliptic, that is the path that the earth follows, as your base of reference, then you can see the earth and the other bodies that move around the sun as following relatively simple curves. They are either circles or ellipses, modified with certain perturbations due to the presence of more than one gravitational field in which they are moving. And carrying that on more fully, we can get by taking the Milky Way as our base of reference, get a simpler picture of the whole stellar universe and the galactic universe, including the extragalactic systems, simpler than if we took either the Earth or our Sun as your base of reference. Now, your base of reference is really a mathematical conception, and logically you can take any one of these, but one is simpler, one is more workable than other alternative ones, and that very fact of simplicity becomes the governing factor in determining which you take. Now, that's very fundamental in the scientific development of the theory. It is not correct to say that one can, one gives you truth and the other doesn't. It's perfect. The picture from the earth as a base of reference would be true from that perspective. If it's worked out correctly from that perspective. And the one with the sun as a center would be true from that perspective.
I think the Harveys are coming.
Yeah. Somebody.
Nick. Oh, Nick is coming too. Nick's all coming. All three of them.
As composed of still finer units, such as electrons, positrons, protons and so forth, and these in terms as being subject to transformation under the appropriate conditions. When the transformation takes place, it appears that ponderable matter assumes a state of radiant energy. Thus, in other words, when an electron meets a positron, both are destroyed and become a flash of radiation. That is your ponderable matter, which is in the form of the electron and the positron, have become a vibratory propulsion that is of the nature of light, though that light in that sense is not restricted to what we call visible light. Light is identical in the physical sense with the whole range of electromagnetic waves which extend from the longest radio waves, which are miles long, all through infrared waves, visible waves, the ultraviolet waves, the X-ray waves, the radium type of waves, and ultimately the several octaves of cosmic waves, altogether something like 60 or more octaves, which make up the whole range of light, of which only one octave gives us visible light. All of that is radiation. When your matter is destroyed, it becomes some complex of rays in that radiation, which extends throughout space, traveling at the rate of visible light, something on the order of 186,000 miles a second. That's energy. The ponderable matter becomes, in that case, sheer energy. Now, that's important to grasp that in connection with understanding this figure. This process, seemingly, is proceeding in the stars continuously and is the source of the energy derived from them upon the surface of the Earth. Apparently, then, the stars are disintegrating in the sense that matter concentrated in bodies at widely separated points in space is being transformed into radiant energy which spreads throughout all space. All of this suggests that the various systems of stars will ultimately disappear as masses of ponderable matter, and in their place will be a space uniformly filled with radiant energy. On the other hand, observation of numerous extragalactic nebulae suggests, very convincingly, that both stars and systems of stars are generated by an aggregation of more or less homogeneous and amorphous matter into concentrated and more or less organized form. These various facts from observation combined with theory suggest the following conclusion. A. That if the history of the stellar universe were traced back far enough in time, we would find a stage wherein there were no stars, but only a more or less homogeneous matter and radiation spread uniformly throughout space. Here, note. According to latest theory, the radiation density at the early, highly condensed stage of the expanding universe was much higher than the matter density. What matter there was present was, however, spread out uniformly. At a later stage of expansion, the radiation density had dropped to equality with that of matter, and at this point, gravitational instability set in, and the galaxies began forming.
Whether there is a universe of experience or not.
whether we are drawn into the state of pure subjectivity where there is no form, or whether we manifest in a universe of expression, something remains unchanged, unaltered, or in other words, invariant in the process. And the symbolic name I used for that was consciousness without an object and without a subject. But here we're showing that there is a similar conception used actually in physics, logically similar. The above conceptions leave us with but one constant or invariant, namely energy. Now there's a note on this, because the term energy here is technical. Actually, the more generally valid space-time invariant concept is that of the directed quantity, energy, momentum, of which energy is merely that part lying along the direction of increasing time. For the sake of simplicity of illustration, we use only the more familiar term, energy. So this familiar term, energy, here would have two phases, the state of radiation and the state of ponderable matter. But in both, we have energy. Now the atom bomb is the proof that ponderable matter can be, at least in some degree, reduced to energy. And it's that reduction of a very small proportion of that ponderable matter that makes the explosive power of the atom bomb. That is the tangible proof. The theory existed before the demonstration. In fact, the whole demonstration, an investment of $2 billion, was made upon a gamble that the theory was correct, and it worked out.
Could I ask a question? I don't know what subatomic means.
The atom that we have entities which we used to think were the fundamental units of the building blocks of the matter, which we call atoms. The Greeks call them atoms. Today, they are merely the chemical atoms. They themselves, however, we know, have a structure and are compounded of still more ultimate components, of which you're familiar with the term electron and the proton, some 1,800 times heavier than the electron, and the positron, which is a positive electron, and the neutron, neutrino, and a vast family of mesons. All of these are components in the total structure of what we used to think was the simple entity, an atom. So the atom itself is a compound. The physics that deals with this inner structure of the atom is what is called subatomic physics. It's a field of physics that has prospered in the 20th century. It is the physics of the 20th century. It is what has made the atom bomb possible. It is what has made a great deal of a modern electronic development possible.
Well, do I understand this correctly? Now, this radiant energy that you mentioned is the same as consciousness, would correspond to consciousness without an object?
No.
It would not?
No. No, it doesn't. I'm glad you bring up the point because we can clarify that. I say we're bringing out the point here that the universe at one stage was predominantly radiant energy, at another stage is predominantly ponderable matter. The written ponderable matter can become radiant energy, and the radiant energy somehow, we believe, can become the ponderable matter, and to oscillate between the two. But there is something that remains unaltered in that process, the invariant. The invariant is the all-important thing to isolate. The invariant there is here called energy, which is a simple name for what is more technically energy momentum. We don't want to be that technical. Now it's this energy, this invariant that corresponds to consciousness without an object. Actually, as I'll point out later, the radiant state corresponds to nirvana. Ponderable matter corresponds to the universe of objects.
But then you have a difference between when you say radiant energy and now you speak of energy.
Yeah, the radiant state of energy and the ponderable state of energy, which is matter. This we say, is the ponderable state of matter. The light coming by which we see is an example of the radiant state of energy. But the one can become the other. It's a basic concept of our modern physics. It's the portion of the matter that becomes radiant energy that gives the explosive power of the atom bomb. Now if we substitute for consciousness without an object the notion of energy, or the universe in the sense of all objects, and by all objects I mean not merely things for sensation, I mean also the whole field of ideas, or the whole field of feeling, tone, states of consciousness, everything whatsoever that can be differentiated, individualized, or made to stand in contrast to something else, all of that is meant by the term universe, samsara, or universe of objects. Now we substitute for the universe the notion of ponderable matter, and for nirvana, the notion state of radiation. We can restate our first aphorisms as follows. Now remember the first aphorism, consciousness without an object is, would be stated in this form, energy is. Second, before ponderable matter was, energy is. Though ponderable matter seems to exist, energy is. It's invariant. It's unchanged. It's the one thing remaining unaltered in all of these changes. When ponderable matter vanishes, yet remaining through all, unabated, energy is. Outside of energy, there is no matter. I also brought in the 11th aphorism, which fitted this context very well. Within energy lie both ponderable matter and radiant energy. Yet, for energy, these two are the same. Now, you have a conception there. A little hard to grasp, but you do find a parallel of it in the Buddhistic sutras. When they speak of the state of the clear light, or shunyata, which means voidness, or the laya vijñāna, which means root consciousness, they will say for this, there is no difference between nirvana and samsara. Now actually, in the realization itself, you find that to be true. That these supremely sweeping states or conceptions actually make no difference to the integral root from which they spring. I know that I refer in Pathway Through the Space and also in earlier in this text to the experience in high indifference where there
One course of action or another course of action has precisely the same significance. Whether one moved into the field of activity in the universe or withdrew into nirvanic peace has precisely the same significance. There was a sense that all creatures, all things, down to the last atom or electron, was already there, that there was no suffering anywhere, that the play of duality simply was for that state of consciousness non-existent. You were aware of the invariant substratum underlying all of this play. Now that can be realized. We're not dealing simply with an arbitrary conception, but with an interpretive conception here.
Could you give us a little illustration and just a little more explanation about nirvana and samsara in our own language?
Nirvana corresponding to the radiant state, the state of consciousness, pure subjective consciousness, where the categories of space, time, development, change, and so forth have no bearing, but a timeless peace and bliss, nirvana. In contrast, and there's no body, no entity, no going from here to there. It's just a timeless bliss. The universe, or samsara, is the play of duality, of manifestation, of becoming and ceasing, of birth and death, of day and night. All that periodicity, all of that process, going on its own level ceaselessly. Now, these two stand as the two poles of the element. But what is a symbol of the element of which these are poles? Various symbols have been used. Laozi used the expression Tao, or the among the Buddhists, Shunyata, brightness, or a lie out of vision. Pops the thought with the Hindu. But in my own work, and for reasons that should become clear as one reads this, I use the symbol of consciousness without an object and without a subject. And as I approach it more from the angle of consciousness, von Hartmann would use the unconscious as a symbol of that. This is the word as implied before Jung. But he says specifically, it's only unconscious from our point of view. From its own point of view, it's superconscious. Thus, there have been different pointing terms indicating this something that is invariant in all things. And I've simply used consciousness without an object and without a subject to express that invariant. In other words, as you find in this philosophy, neither the self nor the universe nor God is the other, but the pure consciousness is the supporter of all selves, of all gods, of all universes.
Going back to this energy, the energy is, that energy has no source, but what operates upon it to make radiant energy a comparable matter?
It's going on another duality. It's almost as if that consciousness was a third factor.
What is that?
It's almost as if that consciousness was a third factor, and radiant energy, and this other factor,
source, yes.
But well, again, we find that evasive third factor.
Hmm?
That there seems to be a third factor there, this consciousness without an object, even when you apply it to physics.
The third factor, well, the third factor, of course, is your energy. With, up here, it's radiant energy down here in front of a matter. Consciousness without an object up here. Nirvana and samsara are the pure self and the object. Universe down here. They're not three there.
Yes.
Now remember that there is a certain distortion just as soon as you try to express this right here. At the moment you can get the truth all this along as you do not speak and do not think.
That's what the Zen Buddhists say. Why are they so evasive in Zen Buddhism? A disciple asked the master for a definition of nirvana and he kicked him in the shin. And another one pointed to a dog.
I think you're laughing at you. I don't get very much out of Zen Buddhism. they try to avoid making anything intelligible as much as they can. But I do go along with the point that the moment you try to convey or to express, you have distorted. And in that very distortion, you have introduced a new duality. But now imagine that you are, that the expression was dissolved, and you are in the ultimate state, now without reflection, no communication, a pure consciousness, not self-conscious, then you'd have to be free from duality. The moment self-consciousness arises in it, then you have a contrast with a pure primordial consciousness and a consciousness conscious of itself. However, I can see that a desirable development.
Well, wouldn't some people call that other state an annihilation?
Yes, that is very common laid down in Buddhism. But it is a very unhappy procedure. And one of the main reasons why Buddhist doctrine has been misunderstood was why, I don't suppose he used the word nihilism himself, but what he described seemed so much like nothing at all that it was interpreted as nihilism, and it wasn't what he meant. The point was that any conception distorts, and you have to say you're going to be strictly correct. It's not this, not that, not anything whatsoever which you can conceive. Now, I'm quite frankly taking the position that it's worthwhile trying to transcribe and convey, for it may arouse an interest. But there's always the warning that anything said, and this goes for every scripture whatsoever, everything said is also a distortion, because it is drawn, let us say, from an n-dimensional consciousness and put into our 2 or 3-dimensional consciousness here, and in that very act distorted and falsified. But in it, there is a pointer. And if one can use that pointer to carry on, it helps. If he hangs on to that pointer, he can be stopped. That's why the so-called fundamentalists or literalists are misusing religion. I use this figure at different times. Suppose you're traveling along a road and you want to go to some city. Let us say it's Las Vegas, taking it random. And you come to a sign which says Las Vegas, so many miles, and a point down that way. And if then you treat that sign as the actual point of arrival, get out and wrap your, of your car and wrap yourself around the post of that sign and say, now I have arrived and I'm going to cling to this. You wouldn't have arrived at all. Well, that illustrates a misuse of scripture.
could attach it to Scripture and take it for
just as a pointer, a pointer to go out. Never hang on to the symbol or the concept as motive. And that is the way I view these concepts here. I have made that point explicitly in the text from time to time. And just about page more, and we'll finish this one of these sections. This physical conception that we've just outlined as a high order of theoretical beauty, and I regard it as one of the finer products of the scientific art. It affects a very great conceptual simplification and enables us to picture a wide range of transformation in nature as experienced within the organization of an essentially simple unifying concept. However, what we have is a construction of the creative intellect, in part operating upon material given through observation, and in part conditioning the observation. We have no right to say that this theory, or any modification which may take place in the future, is nature as it is apart from the consciousness of all thinkers. Any question of the truth or reality value of the theory must be judged in relationship to a conscious thinker. Further, we have no right to assert dogmatically that even though for our science this theory should prove to be ultimately valid, then it must necessarily be valid for any competent thinker whatsoever. In fact, it is entirely possible, nay more, quite probable, that the scientists of an entirely different culture, although of comparable capacity and supplied with comparable resources for investigation, would nonetheless construct an entirely different theoretical structure or the organization of their corresponding experience. Yet this would not discredit the relative validity of the foregoing theory or our present culture. Now that finishes section 7. I think that's enough for this afternoon. What is the time?
Just about the hour.
Hey, would you give us the phone?
We just have enough tape for that.